A lot of, you know, women were never taught that they can listen to their bodies and manage their pain and their stress or their tolerance and exercise training. Women aren't sold fitness like males are, but we also weren't ever sold fitness like athletes, where I think that some of those components are what make better fitness programs. The toned body or that lean body or that fit body that most females are looking for comes from pulling back the volume in their weight training, but driving up that intensity. I think one of the biggest mistakes that women make when it comes to training is restricting their food and or carbohydrate intake too much, too frequently, too often, or all of the time. On top of this is there's this big obsession right now on cortisol. My favorite fact is, like, do you know what brings down cortisol or reduces the cortisol response to exercise?
Today I sit down with exercise scientist Alyssa Olenek, PhD, to discuss what an optimal exercise program for women looks like and whether women should be approaching exercise, nutrition, and recovery just like men do, or if they require a unique approach specific to their anatomy and physiology. This was a 3.5 hour conversation, so we've split it into part one and part two to make it a little more digestible. Across the two parts, you'll learn about myths related to women and exercise, whether women should approach resistance training and cardio differently to men, how to set up resistance training to grow a particular muscle group, for example, your booty, why restricting calories and or carbohydrates might be holding back your progress in the gym, how to know that your sets in the gym are effective, how to know if you're overtraining and need to reduce your load or even take a day off, whether you should ice plunge, how to do cardio effectively, how much protein you should target, what supplements can help you achieve your physical fitness goals, and plenty more. All shot in 4K in a friend's LA workshop. Perfect for throwing up on your TV or downloading to the YouTube app on your phone and watching on the plane. That's a bit of a pro tip, actually. Download podcasts on YouTube and shows on Netflix before traveling. Hopefully all of that sounds good. This is me and Alyssa Olenek, PhD. Please enjoy. One of the best ways to track our health is to regularly get blood work done so we can take a peek under the hood and get a feel for the state of our cardiometabolic and hormonal health. You can do this with your local doctor, or you can use a service like Inside Tracker. The nice thing about Inside Tracker is they make the process super convenient. You can organize their phlebotomist, a person who draws blood, to come to your house or office to do the blood draw. A few days later, your results show up in the Inside Tracker app, and they provide lifestyle recommendations based on whether a particular test is suboptimal, normal, or optimal. I've checked Inside Tracker's lifestyle recommendations, specifically the exercise and nutrition ones, and I can confidently say they are evidence-based and in line with the information shared in both my book and on this show. They even added ApoB to their ultimate plan, based on recommendation from myself and others. It's also nice to have all of your lab results readily accessible in one mobile app, making it easy to pull up past results and see trends and patterns over time. Get 20% off the entire Inside Tracker store. To get started, go to insidetracker.com/Simon for this exclusive offer. That's insidetracker.com/Simon. If you're a long-time listener of this show, you'll be well aware of the scientific evidence that supports a high-fiber, plant-rich diet for good long-term health. And while I certainly believe in a food-first approach, there is a role for supplements to help optimize the intake of specific nutrients and address any nutritional gaps. Enter Amil. Amil is a plant-based wellness company with a series of products to help you optimize your plant-based diet. Two of my favorite products being the Essential 8 multivitamin and the Optimal Omega Plus. The Essential 8 contains 8 key nutrients that plant-based eaters often fall short in. And the Optimal Omega Plus contains a direct source of DHA and EPA omega-3s, same as in fish, but from algae. In fact, taking Optimal Omega Plus daily, which contains 750 milligrams of EPA and DHA, is equivalent to eating 2 to 3 pieces of fatty fish per week, in line with the nutrition recommendations globally. To get your Essential 8 and Optimal Omega Plus, head to theproof.com/friends and follow the link, which will get you an extra 10% off your first order. That's theproof.com /friends. Alyssa, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
It's a pleasure. I've been watching from afar, and as we were just talking about off air, I've really enjoyed watching the content that you're sharing online related to exercise and physical fitness, and particularly focusing on women. I think you do such a great job at kind of disseminating what can be a little bit complex and maybe inaccessible, and then making it very accessible. So really looking forward to this.
I appreciate that. And the fun fact before we dive on all this today, it's International Women's Day today. Mm-hmm, did you know that? I didn't plan that.
How fitting.
It is, but it's very fitting for today's conversation. So I'm super excited, and thank you.
I did know that because this morning I went and got a coffee just around the corner here on Abbot Kinney in Venice, and Nike was handing out runners for International Women's Day.
I can't believe I missed that.
I actually got two pairs, so.
Really?
Yeah.
Good for you.
What size are you?
A 9.5.
Okay, damn it. Yeah. I'm not going to fit.
No.
I got 7.5, and that was a present from my mom. Mm.
So that's okay. Give it to your mom. She needs it more than me, probably.
My intent for this conversation, just to kind of put that on the table and see what you think, is really three main things. To kind of get clearer on what a good exercise program looks like for a woman who is generally interested in her health and being physically fit, reducing her risk of chronic disease and longevity. So, you know, perhaps not really performance or super performance focused.
Yes.
More that avatar of that everyday woman that is looking just to be physically fit. I want to understand whether exercise prescription for her would be the same as it would be for a man, or whether there is evidence that it might differ. And then whether or not things may change through different life stages that a woman may go through or will go through, so premenopausal, pregnancy, breastfeeding, perimenopause, menopause, all of these different life stages.
Yeah.
Sound like a good plan?
That sounds like a good plan, and I promise I won't try to convince anyone on your listeners to be as extreme as me. But I do bring my – I joke that my bias is that I view the world through the lens as a trained exercise physiologist. So I will try to convince the listeners that they should take their fitness goals seriously, even if they aren't extreme.
Yeah, tell me about that. So that lens that you view through as an exercise physiologist, scientist.
Yeah.
What does your academic journey look like so far, and how do you use science to kind of inform the recommendations that you provide online?
Yeah, so I really grew up an athlete, and so that's what sparked all my passion and excitement for that. And I remember this pivotal moment when I was younger where I was like, I kind of want to learn as much as I can about this to share with everyone else. I was like 13, 14, and I was like, that's what I want to do. And so I just really stayed on that path. And so, you know, athletics and sport brought me to fitness, but it was something that I felt like was a gift that I could give to people that they didn't know that they had the opportunity for. And I wanted to share that with people. So I went and got my undergrad, pre-professional health science. Exercise science was more of my focus. And that's where I got exposed to research and science. I played lacrosse and I ended up quitting because I got really, really into school and science. I never knew that I was smart and science was for me. And then I kind of went down this rabbit hole where I was like really excited about that. And once I got exposed to research and I found out you can get paid to go to grad school and do research and think, I was really excited about that. And so I graduated early and did an internship at the Pitt Neuromuscular Research Center. And then I went and got my master's at Western Kentucky University. And that's where I was first exposed to the female physiology stuff. I had female mentors. I started doing female-led research. And I had no idea about the sex gaps in research at that point in time. I was just excited in metabolic health and improving people's metabolic health. I was really passionate about that. I really had that pivotal switch in research if I wanted to go like strength and conditioning or, you know, metabolism, metabolic health, lifespan type stuff. And I always felt like exercise was a gift to give people health. So I kind of chased that a little bit more. And so I started getting into human metabolism, postprandial response type research. I did do a little bit of pregnancy stuff at that time. My mentors were very into pregnancy. And then I kind of brought that with me into my PhD, which I completed almost 2 years ago, next month at the University of Georgia, where I did a lot of work in, you know, metabolic flexibility and postprandial meal response, exercise, metabolism. But then a lot of my coursework was in sports nutrition and muscle physiology and all that classic exercise physiology stuff as well. But I've always viewed exercise as a tool for improving our health, not just a tool for performance, but, you know, improved performance is also an indicator of health. I always kind of have that opinion. And then I'm currently finishing up a postdoc at the University of Colorado, Anschutz Medical Center, where I'm extending my training. You know, I did a lot of menstrual cycle stuff in my, and sex comparison stuff in my PhD, and I wanted to expand that to the whole lifespan. So starting to learn more about that peri and menopausal and postmenopausal time period to kind of have that breadth and depth of exercise, but also, you know, women's metabolic health across the entire lifespan and rounding out my knowledge with that.
You mentioned there sex gaps. Mm-hmm. Unpack what you mean by that.
Yeah. So actually me and a team of really incredible young females in this field have been doing this thing called Invisible Sportswoman. We're on version 3 of it right now, where during the pandemic, it was kind of a pandemic project with me and my friend Emma, who's the lead author on that and led everything, where we started to look at the gaps of, you know, exercise science and sports science studies done on females versus males within the last 5 years. It was a follow-up from a paper that had done it up to like 2014, and we found that I might be messing our numbers up, but about 6% of studies in exercise and sports science in the top 5 major journals were done on female-only topics. And then about, I think it's 32 to 34% of total participants were done on females. And so, and the next version of that, which was just published this past year, you know, we looked at lead versus last authorship, editorial board memberships, study quality, and studies done on just females, and found, you know, that there is a lot of this work that's high quality and that's being done is led by female academics. But we also know there's that leaky pipeline in science. And so right now in this third edition, which we're about to just start doing interviews for, we're doing a little bit of a qual analysis, is seeing like, okay, if females are leaving sports science and academia and or going industry, why are they leaving? What are these choices? Because if they're the ones leading this work, right? Like, where are we losing this along the way?
So, what's this going to look like in 10, 20 years?
Yeah, because we do, you know, I think there's a big push in awareness. And this goes beyond sports science, right? Like, I know, especially with menopause, people are very upset about the lack of research and data on that. The NIH does have a pretty big initiative with that and getting more funding out with that. But at least in sports science, everyone, you know, gets upset that everything's compared to this 74 kilo male or whatever the cliche trope that people like to use. But, you know, the research is possible, but, you know, it's not well funded. But also, why aren't people doing it? And then why are the people that are doing it getting kind of lost along the way, right?
Why is it that most studies are of men or men and women, but there's very little only female studies? Is it because women are trickier to study? Is that one reason?
So that's the thought, is that it's more complicated, so to speak, to research females. And so as much as I'm on this very pro of like, okay, there's these definite sex gaps, I feel like I get defensive of early exercise science research, because I think, you know, even though like I'm the second author on that publication, I'm still defensive of the fact that just because there's less research doesn't mean there's none. I think people think that there's none. And then I get defensive of early exercise physiology, because if you look at our field historically, some of the really early studies coming out of like the Howey and Cowley and Brooks, George Brooks labs and all that stuff, I might be butchering their last names, they did a lot of their studies they did on males and females. But I think that in the early 2000s, in the last 20 years, a lot of this stuff that, you know, we, so to speak, established our guidelines or exercise training protocols appears to be very largely done on males. And a lot of that comes from the fact that, you know, it's harder to control for the menstrual cycle. And so a lot of people will avoid doing that because it's either more steps, it extends the timeline of your study, or it requires more money to analyze and control these things. And so I think there's been a good push now of like encouraging more researchers to at least include females in their study along with their males. I don't think that, you know, the 6% of them are just on female-specific topics, which I don't think we need 100% of the female-only studies to be just done on the menstrual cycle, because female health and performance is more than just the menstrual cycle, so to speak. But I think that if you're going to include males in studies, I think there's a lot more push for justification of why you aren't including females as well. In, you know, publications and journals are asking for that justification, or even like, you know, people who are putting these studies together, like, okay, can you have a female group, or is this question specific to males, so to speak? And yeah, a lot of that does come down to the fact that it's more complicated and there's more control, and that adds more stress and money to research, which is already itself time consuming and costs a lot of money to do.
Yeah, I often see comments on social media, and it will be a claim of, you know, such and such maybe it's like a type of exercise or sauna, affected the regularity of my period.
Yeah.
And then I jump into the research and, you know, there may be studies that have included women, but perhaps they weren't even measuring regularity of menstruation. Right.
Yeah. And I think that it's just kind of become this forgotten physiological variable. And, you know, there's definitely a part of research and science that views it as a burden of what they have to control for rather than something that might be affecting outcomes or even like might be impacted by the like sauna or all these things that people are doing nowadays. I know there was even stuff that came out, you know, during the pandemic and, you know, the vaccines potentially impacting menstrual cycles. And it was kind of a forgotten variable of those early clinical trials. And, you know, women were frustrated because they were like, well, why is my cycle heavy or delayed? And so I do think that sometimes it becomes this forgotten variable, especially when we think about potentially that there's a very male-centric view, at least in sport and health and exercise science. But I do think that that gap is slowly starting to close. I mean, the Olympics are going to be at 50-50. There's more push for female health awareness coming from sports bodies. And I think that will hopefully trickle into then, you know, the push in the health sphere as well to like, let's understand how these things are impacting us.
Are current exercise guidelines, are they just broad? They encompass men and women, or are they broken? Is there sufficient evidence as it stands right now? Because you mentioned it's not as if there is no evidence. There is some evidence. Is there sufficient evidence to suggest that general recommendations for exercise should be distinctly different for women versus men?
I'm of the opinion that I don't think that we need these super specific, unique, niche female exercise training guidelines. Most things that work for males work for females. I think that there might become more data and evidence that comes out that might refine some of the details that say, hey, you know, maybe women need a little bit more of this, or maybe a little bit less of this, or this is really important and that focus should come from here are the things that we should maybe value a bit more or push for, or there might be some differences. So for example, there was a paper that was just published recently that showed that, you know, women get this like more benefit or the same amount of benefit from exercise with less total minutes or time than males that just came out. And I haven't teased the data apart enough to say like, okay, this is conclusive and we should change the entire guidelines on this. But I think if that might be potentially something where we're like, oh, okay, like you get more bang for your buck, at least in that premenopausal state, potentially because of this. And some of that might have to do with estrogen and its health protective effects in that state of why we're getting benefits of that and things like that. Or like there's some studies that show, okay, females might need less rest time during intervals of high intensity interval training because we're more oxidative and we recover faster. Or we can train potentially at a higher percent of our one rep max because we have differences in like neuromuscular efficiency. And those are where I think we'll see small training details come along. But I don't think that it's going to be ever to a point where we're getting totally different exercise guidelines, especially when we're talking about like the broad sweeping general population who's hardly getting in enough activity as it is. These small details maybe come later after they get those big, you know, foundational or basics, as people like to call them, or those key cornerstones of health and fitness and what we want for moving the needle forward. But I do think that I would love to see some of that refinement, but I don't think it's ever going to be at the point where like the WHO or the ACSM is going to say, oh, you need to train differently. And I think that in the social media sphere, people really think that that's where we should go and where things should be. But I think it's disingenuous also to a lot of the literature that shows that females adapt very similarly to males when they undergo exercise training routines, and that our strength potential relative to at least our own body weight and size is very similar. There was a review meta done by Brandon Roberts a few years ago, and I think Greg Knuckles as well, and they looked at this, and the women actually gained more upper body strength, but we think that might be just due to more of a lower baseline starting, less exposure to sport and fitness early on. But other than that, our
newbie gains.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But our potential is very, very similar to that, at least relative to our own selves. We're maybe never going to be as big and as strong as the elite males, but we have a lot of potential. And I do think there's a lot of overlap there too, right? We see this a lot of strength athletes in sports and, you know, women on that upper end of things as we, you know, we look at people just in the training spaces. And so I think our potential is very similar, but I think those small details of refinement might come out slowly as we continue to push. And this is, you know, hopefully it's in my career and my lifespan, but I think everyone wants it yesterday. But research takes a really long, slow time. And I think the next 10, 20 years, we might get some of those answers.
So where is, I guess, some of this information that you'll see on social media around individualization or personalization for women training, you know, a certain way at a particular time of the month, maybe in the follicular phase of the cycle, and then differently in the luteal phase. And if there isn't necessarily, I guess, strong evidence to support that, why are we seeing that? Is that a sexier story? Is that an easier way to sell something? I'm making you speculate.
Yeah.
But I'd be interested to kind of hear what
you have. I have lots of opinions on this. So I've thought about this a lot. So I think it's coming from a few places. I think that some of it is the literature and the science and what we're seeing that is premature or very low effect size or very messy data at this time, where there's some themes and patterns that we're seeing that I think, like, I think a lot of people take the camp on the antagonist of, they're like, there's nothing changing, nothing's different, everything's the same, you're just like you're the same the entire month. And I'm like, well, there's a little bit of nuance and individuality to that. But I think on the hyper swing, a lot of it, I think, is a response to, I joke that it's a response to the way fitness industry has treated females, not actually sport or exercise science or health science has treated females, where for years there was this push of extreme, HIIT, fat loss focused only, extreme cardio, like under eat, feed yourself, like push yourself, all pain, no gain. And I think that a lot of, you know, women were never taught that they can listen to their bodies and manage their pain and their stress or their tolerance and exercise training or auto-regulation, or they don't typically get sold or promoted well-balanced programs that balance intensity and volume in a way that's recoverable. And so when they find something like cycle syncing, they then find something that potentially brings them back below that threshold of either low energy availability or recoverability, or they're not burning the candle at both ends. And they do genuinely feel better. But what happens though on that side, I think, is a hyper swing in response to that very early mid-2000s or last, you know, 20 years of that extremeness, where they, you know, want to kind of have that step back from that extremeness that we've always been sold, because women aren't sold fitness like males are, but we also weren't ever sold fitness like athletes, where I think that some of those components are what make better fitness programs. But what happens though is it becomes a secondhand game of telephone where everyone's communicating something that gets misconstrued along the way. And it's just confusing. And now you have these cycle syncing protocols, but none of them are the same. They're all different. Everyone's telling you to do a different thing at a different phase. And like, it's kind of made up. And what I think my frustrations with this side of it a lot of time is that they're mad that we don't have enough data on women and that we need more data and that we're treated like males, but then we're giving women secondhand hypotheses as truth. And that frustrates me, because you're not actually giving them anything credible. You're just saying, well, this might happen to this, or this might happen here, so you should only train like this. And we don't have any data to say that you should only do Pilates or walk for 7, 10, 14 days of the month, but it's just, oh, it's inflammatory or it's not recoverable, so you should just kind of pull back and do nothing. And I think an issue there is that a lot of the people coming from that side of things, they don't have formal training in exercise science, sports science, exercise physiology, so they don't understand how good training programs kind of come about. So the solution is to just, well, you pull it all back.
Right. Well, it's a very compelling story, because there are anatomical and physiological differences between men and women.
Yeah. Right?
So as you just said, hypothesis.
Yeah.
So of course there could be all sorts of hypotheses that women are going to respond differently to training, and perhaps at different times of the month they respond differently again, or different stages of their life. So I can see how, particularly for someone who doesn't feel like they're getting results, that they would come across that information, and it's a very compelling, strong argument.
It's a sexy story. You've been left out. You've been forgotten. You've been trained like a man, and I'm going to train you like the female that you are, and it's going to get you all these results, and it's going to work better for you. Most of the time, when it's good, it's just repackaged strength training with a pink bow, if I'm being honest, or at the worst end is this work with your body, listen to your body type thing that I think people think is independent of what a good training program can also include.
I'm just thinking about how someone might push back on this.
I've gotten all the pushback on this.
I think one thing that comes to mind is, I think someone might say absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, right? And you, what I heard earlier from you is you're not saying that there might be differences in terms of how women respond to exercise compared to men, but we don't have the resolution right now with the current data to know what those differences are, to be able to prescribe very different set of exercise recommendations for women.
Yes.
But you are saying it could be possible.
So there's two things I think people lump the menstrual cycle and sex differences into the same bucket. And there's sex differences and then there's menstrual cycle differences. And right now, I think we have some stuff that is more clear on sex differences and how either we respond or adapt our potential or all of that stuff. And it's a little bit more clear. But what people want is that menstrual cycle difference. They want to know, should I train different in my follicular phase versus my luteal phase? And I think that there's going to be potentially fine-tuned variations that may come out more and more. And I think people think that I'm very anti-cycle syncing in the sense that I'm not open to or excited to the literature growing as we go through the years. There's actually been a couple clinical trials pushed through that they're going to actually start trying to look at this a little bit more. And hopefully over the years, we can maybe have some more specific guidelines. But I don't think what will come of that is going to look like the current state of a lot of these claims around how you should train around your cycle. I think there's some variations of this that are definitely more refined and more data-driven and potentially better than some other forms of that out there. So it's not to say I'm against that, but I think right now we just don't have strong enough data to say you should only do X at this time or Y at this time. I think if anything, it's okay, maybe you drive up this here and you drive this down here, or you focus on recovery more here, but you're not changing every single week the routine or movement style or type of exercise that you're doing. And if anything, I think that complicates exercise for females even more. And I think that ends up inadvertently adding a barrier to people who are already falling further below the exercise guidelines when we think about the gen pop and healthy populations. And I think that there might be a time and place for considering hormones, but it comes after all of these other steps and which we need to get to at that first. Because at the time right now, the data is pretty much conclusive of, and it should be individualized. So it's not to say that your individual experience is invalid. It's that the cycle you have this month might not be the same as the cycle you have next month. And it's not the same cycle that your friend is having, and your response and how that impacts you won't be exactly the same. And that's what makes it complicated. So I always like to say that I think that it's this, and I sympathize greatly with this deep desire from women to want to have data and information about themselves, but it's not that they then in turn are wanting this one-size-fits-all thing. But the reality is that you are so individual and unique that it's really still going to be based on you and your symptomology and your menstrual cycle experience, because that's going to change. And I went to the Female Athlete Conference last year and I saw some really interesting data I don't think it's published yet, but it was really neat where they tracked people's performance over two cycles, and the phases that they performed better in changed cycle to cycle, even within the same person. And that's why I think this gets messy and complicated, because you're not having the same exact cycle every single month for the rest of your life. Or, you know, your hormone levels or how you're sensitive to those compared to someone else might be different, or your PMS symptoms might be different. So you might have a more detrimental impact of your cycle on your performance or your exercise training than someone else, but that means that it should adapt to you. Not everybody should be fed the same one-size-fits-all 28-day perfect Pinterest graphic meme version of how to train.
Right. So does that come back to what you said earlier, listening to your body? Mm-hmm. Is that where this becomes important?
Yeah. So I think that the reason this sells is because it's kind of giving, you know, women this permission to rest, or take a rest day, or take a step back, or take it easy if they are feeling really terrible. And so auto-regulation is something that's really common in the strength fields, especially coming from powerlifting and very more strength-focused individuals. But I think it's a really great tool that I think replaces cycle syncing in a way that allows people to have the tools to adjust their training based off how they feel. So auto-regulation is essentially this skill or tool that you use the inputs of your day and your life and how you feel, because I always like to say, you know, menstrual cycles might impact your performance in the gym or whatever you're doing, but you are more than just a menstrual cycle. You also have sleep and stress and your job or your kids or all these other inputs coming into your system, right? And all of that are going to affect how you feel any day showing up in the gym or your training sessions. And some days you might feel like absolute garbage, or some days you might feel awesome, independent of the phase of the cycle that you're in, from all these different factors coming into your life. But auto-regulation essentially is a tool that says on a scale of 1 to 10, so rating of perceived exertion is often a scale that people use, on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, you should go to this effort. And typically with strength training, it's like a 7 to 9 range. And then endurance training, it's like a 4 to a 10, depending on the day. But you can adjust the weight on the bar, or the pace of what you're going, or the effort of what you're going based on how you feel on any given day. And I think that it counts and captures a lot of things that might be changing within the cycle itself. And so to give more specific examples of that, you know, with the data we do have on the menstrual cycle, you may have better performance or strength outcomes in the follicular phase or late follicular phase, and you may have poor strength performance in that late luteal into that early follicular or menstrual cycle phases. But if you use autoregulation, that doesn't mean you have to increase the weight every single week. It's, okay, well, this week you might go up, and this week you don't feel as great, so you go back 5 or 10 pounds, and the next week you go up. But over time, you're still able to make progress, but you're also working within how you feel, how fast the bar is moving, how hard, you know, your pace or effort is going. And you can adjust that based off how you feel. And you can, and that's, you know, it's prescriptive to like, hey, work to this target. It doesn't matter what weight or what pace it is. It's how hard is that feeling? And I think that that's one of the most important tools that I think can allow people to kind of take ownership of their own cycle and their own symptomology and how they feel. And then also recognizing that, you know what, every single month on this day, I feel terrible and the last thing I want to do workout. And you have permission to just not train on that day. But that's not cycle syncing. That's just, you know, adjusting your weekly schedule and program to accommodate for your symptoms. But I don't think that's cycle syncing in the sense of like, oh, you're only allowed to do this type of exercise on days X through Y, so to speak.
Break that down a little bit more for me. So let's say someone is feeling a little more tired than normal. Their energy is a little lower.
Yeah.
And they're wondering if they should go in and do their resistance training today.
Yeah.
Are you saying that their rating of perceived effort, rather than that being a sort of 7 to 9 out of 10, they would aim for something lower than that?
Potentially. So you can take it two ways. So say I am going in to do back squats and I'm doing them with 100 pounds. My strongest week. My strongest week, an 8 out of 10 effort is 100 pounds for 6 reps. But the next week, I don't feel so great. You know, maybe I am in my luteal phase, or maybe I'm really stressed, work's been really busy, or maybe I didn't sleep so great. I'm going back in the gym to do the same set of 6 back squats at the same 8 out of 10 effort. But this week, I don't feel so great. So maybe I'm putting 85 pounds on that bar because 85 pounds feels like an 8 out of 10 effort. Or if you are super exhausted, super fatigued, feeling wrecked, and you don't feel like you even have it in you to go an 8 out of 10, well, maybe you just go and do a 6 or 7 out of 10 at the gym that day. You pull back a little bit. I'm hesitant to say pulling back for strength training to like maybe a 3 or a 4. You know, you still want it to be effective.
Because you lose that stimulus.
Yeah, you still want to be, at least 30% with hypertrophy, but most people aren't taking enough reps to get to that point, but kind of 60% of that one rep max or higher range for most people. But you can just take that back, or you know, you can say, okay, I have 3 sets today, but I'm just going to do 2. I'm just going to do 2 hard sets and then move on to the next thing. So you're cutting volume or intensity in ways that work best for you. And I know that's not super direct for people because they're like, okay, so there's all these different ways that I can adjust my program. And it's one of those things that either a coach can help you with or trial and error. But when we think about what makes exercise fatiguing or unrecoverable, it's usually volume more than necessarily intensity. I think people, they immediately jump to pulling back the weight on the bar. Or even the pace that they're going at or how intense they're going. But the volume can be cut other ways too. You can still get that stimulus of that intensity that you're looking for, but you can pull back how much you're doing and that decreases that volume. So if somebody is having, you know, their luteal phase feels terrible for them or their late luteal phase or menstrual phase, they feel under-recovered, they feel super fatigued, you know, their pain perception's higher, they still want to get in the gym, you can either pull back that RPE a little bit, or they can say, I have 3 sets and I'm going to do 2 hard sets and be done for the day. Those are kind of the 2 options of which I suggest to people.
And the RPE, just to clarify, if someone hasn't heard that abbreviation before, is just rating of perceived
exertion.
And that's just a scale of your effort out of 10.
Yeah, on a scale of 1 to 10. And so it works for both cardio and strength training. So for strength training on a scale of 1 to 10, like I said, most of the time it's maybe 6, but usually 7, 8, maybe if you're working really hard on, you know, more close to failure, that 9 to 10 level effort. And usually that corresponds to something called RIR or reps in reserve. And so another way that you can teach this to people who have a hard time with like, well, what the heck does an 8 out of 10 feel like? You know, 10 means I could do 0 reps, 9 means I could do 1 more rep, 8 means I could do 2 more reps. And so what I usually tell people, especially women, because they tend to underload themselves in the gym, is take a set to failure to know what that feels like. And then you'll kind of learn with time, oh, I could do maybe 1 or 2 more reps, but I'm going to stop here because you don't have to go all the way to that. And that's sometimes an inverse way of thinking it. That's easier for people. And then on the contrary, for the cardio side, you have this 1 to 10 scale. But with cardio training, you kind of go across the breadth and the depth of that scale when you're doing cardio training. So you might do slower and easier stuff that's like a 3 to 4 effort, moderate stuff that's like a 5 to 6 effort, and then the higher intensity stuff that's a 7 to 10 effort. So they're not exactly used the same way depending on the type of training that you're doing. But I think with Gen Pop people, it's sometimes easy to say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how hard did that feel? And that, I think so many people are familiarized with 10-point scales and Likert scales, that if you know what fatigue feels like or you know what max effort feels like, that gives you an anchor for that. But it's sometimes easy to say, oh man, this week, oh man, that feels like a 7. I can't do any more than that. I'm just completely wiped out. And just keeping the weight there or the pace there and the intensity there, and knowing that your body's still getting that stress and stimulus, so to speak, because you're giving that day's version of 100%.
Right. So you can back the volume off by reducing the number of sets, reps, or the load,
yeah,
or a combination mm-hmm. of those. At what point is it just better to take the day off?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you are, especially if we're thinking in the light of the menstrual cycle or in life in general, if you wake up and you've had a crummy night's sleep, you know, we're talking maybe 3, 4, 5, maybe even 6 hours of sleep. I don't like to be the coach or person who's like, one bad sleep and you should never work out. But you know those nights when you wake up and you kind of feel like battery acid. Like you're just like, I feel horrific. I had a terrible night's sleep. Or you've been underfed. You haven't been eating consistent meals. You're not eating enough. You don't have enough food in your body. You're dehydrated or you're not adequately hydrated. Those are usually my key things that if I'm feeling tired, quote unquote, but I'm well rested, I'm fed, I'm hydrated. You know, if I'm like, oh, I'm tired, I'm not in the mood to do this, then I'm like, okay, well, go to the gym, because your body's in a state where you're going to recover and you're going to be supported. But if you're underfed, underslept, overstressed, and you're having potentially poor recovery, your PMS symptoms are super high, maybe it's, hey, you know what? I'm going to just take a rest day today, or I'm going to move that more intense workout to later in the week, and I'm going to do something easier today, and learning how to balance and move that around. So a good example for myself is, try to take my rest days on Thursdays. But last Wednesday, I woke up and I felt like I couldn't put enough calories in my body. I couldn't drink enough water. I was exhausted. I felt horrific. And I was like, my training session is just not going to be good today. It's just not going to be good. And I know my body wants rest. And I think that's the thing that a lot of women were told to ignore that. Keep going. Go to the HIIT class. Go to that boot camp class. You need to burn fat today. You need to keep pushing, pushing, pushing. But you have that permission to say, you know what? I feel absolutely wrecked today. And it's okay to do that, because we're the accumulation of all of our training. Not one individual session here or there is going to make or break all of these things. And I think that learning, that's where autoregulation comes into at a broader scale. If you can learn what makes your body feel good and ready and primed to go in the gym, and what makes it where you feel horrific when you leave the gym.
Right. So that day of recovery, prioritizing recovery, might then allow you to get a better stimulus in your following training sessions in the week to come versus not taking that day off and just having a suboptimal stimulus day after day.
Yeah. And I think that if you're someone who's super busy and you're on this tight schedule and that's the only thing that you can do, and you're like, well, I have to do something today, you have to have a conversation with yourself. It's like, is this, and this happens when people are sick or injured or all of these things. Will this move me forward or is it going to dig me back? I like to ask clients that a lot. It's like, is this session, is pushing myself right now, is it going to just dig me in a deeper hole, or is it just going to maintain me or move me forward, kind of thing? And I think if you're in a state or condition where you're like, okay, this is going to dig me in a bigger hole, or like maybe it is, you just skip that day, even if you can't make it up the next day, like you don't have that freedom and flexibility to move your schedule around as you want. Maybe you're like, this is going to dig me too deep in that recovery hole of whatever that looks like for you. And maybe this week, this just isn't an option for me. And I usually encourage my more general pop clients, if that's happening week after week after week, let's adjust your training schedule and split so it's more realistic, so you can get it in without always having to compromise that. Because then I think a lot of women beat themselves up if they can't get their training in perfectly and they can't meet all these things or do all this stuff. And I like giving people the permission of like, well, if you can't do 3 days every week, what if we just go to 2 until you feel like you can do 3 again? And you have that permission though, right? And that broad scale of adjusting based off your life and what you can do to make it work for you and what you're doing and like the season you're in. So sometimes it's an acute day to day. I'm fatigued. I haven't slept. I'm underfed. I can't do this today. This is just not happening, versus like, okay, this keeps not happening. And where do I need to assess and audit where I need to either take care of myself better or pull back until I can do more again?
If you've tuned in to the many episodes I've done focusing on cardiovascular disease, the leading cause of death globally, you'll be well aware that ApoB is a better biomarker for measuring our risk of having a heart attack or stroke than LDL cholesterol. The only problem is that not every pathology lab is set up to test ApoB levels. Fortunately, this has now been made easier by Inside Tracker, a leading health and wellness company, founded in 2009 by experts in aging, genetics, and biometric data from Harvard, MIT, and Tufts that provides lifestyle advice based on your blood test results. With the new addition of ApoB, InsideTracker's Ultimate Plan now analyzes 44 biomarkers, including metabolic health markers like HbA1c, triglycerides, and blood glucose, important nutrients like vitamin D and iron, as well as hormones like cortisol, sex hormone binding globulin, free testosterone, and total testosterone, before giving you science-backed lifestyle advice to optimize your health and longevity. Your data tells the story of your health. With Inside Tracker, get to know your story and create a lifestyle that delivers better health for longer. Get 20% off the entire Inside Tracker store. To get started and redeem this offer, go to insidetracker.com/Simon. That's insidetracker.com/Simon. Hey friends, the scientific evidence on lifestyle habits that lead to longevity is clear. Now it's time to put this knowledge into action. I'm excited to announce the Living Proof Longevity Challenge, a 12-week program to build evidence-based lifestyle habits to optimize longevity. My team and I have transformed over hundreds of hours of conversations with experts on aging, nutrition, and exercise into a life-changing 12-week program that will challenge you to develop habits that lead to a longer, better life. This is a unique opportunity to gather health data about yourself that has the potential to change your life for the better. You'll start by testing 10 longevity biomarkers that tell the truth about where your longevity stands right now, today. Following that, you'll get a personalized longevity score to guide your 12 weeks of habit building that will boost your score and improve your biomarkers for the better. After the challenge, you'll retest your 10 biomarkers and see the proof of how powerful these science-backed habits really are. Head over to theproof.com/livingproof to download your zero-cost copy of the Living Proof Longevity Challenge today. That's theproof.com/livingproof. Look forward to joining you on this journey. What do you think is better, having three kind of average workouts in a week or two really good workouts?
I think that's a hard question. I like the frequency of movement, especially for, you know, if we're really focused on Gen Pop people, I feel like people being active as frequently as possible is a good thing. But there's also the quality and intensity of what you're getting out of those sessions that does elicit the gain. So I'm more on the side of, if you can only get in two really high quality sessions, but you can stay active in other ways across the week, I think I'd rather you do that than like three mediocre sessions, but then you're more sedentary or not doing a ton of stuff across the week. I think you still have to take that bird's eye view of like, how active are you being outside of just those gym sessions? But like, I would rather people get like two lifting sessions where they can go to that 7, 8 out of 10 effort 2 days a week and pushing hard and actually being able to develop muscle and strength with that than going to the gym 3 days a week and going to a 4 to 5 effort kind of thing. I think with cardio, you have a little bit more flexibility because there's benefits to that easier stuff and the harder stuff. So you can say, hey, you know what, I'm going to just do 3 easier days instead of 2 harder days because that feels better to me in this week or this phase of life for how I feel, so to speak. There's a little bit of like, well, it depends on your goal and how much time you have, so to speak. But I really do like making sure we don't neglect intensity in our training, because especially for people who are just getting in what they can, that's where the driver for most of the results is going to come from. Where when we think of people who have bigger performance goals or athletes, they have so much volume that's driving a lot of their adaptations as well.
When you say intensity, mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
So intensity, I mean the load on the bar or the effort of what you're moving. So that's where I think that the 10-point scale is helpful for people. So for lifting, hitting that 7, 8, or 9 out of 10 intensity, Or for cardiovascular training, you know, you have your easy stuff, but you have some stuff that's at 7, 8, 9 out of 10. And that's what I think of more of like quality stuff rather than just like going through the motions and just, you know, you see people do it all the time where they go to the gym, especially with resistance training, and they are just kind of going through the motions. They're looking around, they're not focused, they're just moving through things. Like, you're not getting as much out of that session than if you ramp up the weight, which is ramping up intensity on that. So then you're having to focus more and work harder, and that's giving more of that stimulus. So not kind of being actively engaged in the activity that you're doing. Trying, I guess, is like one of my favorite cues with weightlifting, as my coach always says, try. And so you're having to actually try and be focused. I think that that requirement of focus is a great indicator for people because they don't know, am I going hard enough? Am I at a 7, 8, or 9, or a 10? Like, does it require you to actually focus on what you're doing? And that's how you usually know intensity is there, because you can't just watch the birds and look around when you're actually having to dial in something and perform and execute.
Is that something that you think sort of stifles the progress for a lot of women? If someone's listening and thinking, hey, I'm going into the gym 4 days a week, I do some cardio, I'm lifting weights 3 times a week, my body composition isn't really changing, I don't feel stronger.
Yeah.
Does that often come back to intensity?
I think it's a mix of... Well, I think it is intensity, but I think it's like the wrong types of intensities are too much of it all the time. So this is where it's difficult with females. So I'm glad you followed up with that, is that I think women do too much cardio intensity all the time and not enough strength training intensity. So I think that they need to, but on the contrary, I guess on the strength part, they do a ton of volume. They do a ton of reps and sets and like a million, like 4 by 12 for 10 exercise in a training program. So they're doing too much work, but not enough intensity. Because when you're doing that much work, you can't do it all at the highest, most quality intensity, because you can't do all of that work. It's, you know, intensity is going to suffer there. Similarly with cardio, they're doing high intensity of some sort every single day of the week, all of the time for everything. And eventually, yes, that more quality, higher end stuff, that suffers because it ends up becoming moderate intensity for everything. Or they're only doing high intensity and they're not enough doing easy intensity, and they're not balancing or polarizing or, you know, making that so across the week you're doing some easy stuff that's recoverable, and then making sure the days that you are going high or hard intense that it's of actual quality so you can go high and hard intense. So the mistakes I see a lot of, you know, women doing is that they do too much what they perceive to be high intensity cardio too often. And this is coming from somebody who's very pro cardio. This is not to say I'm anti cardio, but they do too much of this high intensity or moderate intensity all the time cardio. And it's not specific and progressible. And it's just to kind of burn calories or get it in, or they associate that with fat loss and a good body. And then in the weight training, the type of weight training that women are typically sold is this high rep, lower intensity, higher volume training rather than less is more, but
and
let's do higher quality.
The concern there is often, at least from what I hear, women are concerned with getting bulky.
Yeah.
If you're pulling that load up.
Yes, yes. And I think that they're afraid of the heavy training. And again, volume drives that. And so if you're lifting 2 or 3 days a week, you're probably not going to be doing enough volume to become like the next female bodybuilder who's doing a perfectly curated 6-day split and tracking every morsel of food that's going into her mouth. But the tone body, or that lean body, or that fit body that most females are looking for comes from pulling back the volume in their weight training, but driving up that intensity of what they're doing. They're adding load to that. And so that intensity is necessary for those adaptations that you're doing, but you also need that volume component of it too. So they kind of don't get enough of, they kind of get like too much of the wrong stuff and not enough stuff of the right stuff when they're doing their program. So it's just a lot of, or they kind of fall in that middle and they only do circuit training, boot camp style stuff that's like moving weights fast. So they're not ever doing a specific cardio stimulus and they're never doing a specific weight training stimulus. So they're not doing enough to like, I mean, from a general health standpoint, if like you, it's probably fine cardiovascularly. They probably get enough of that to some degree, but they're not ever getting enough of that weight training stimulus to grow that muscle or strength, especially in the way that they typically want for changing their body. So they feel frustrated because they're like, I'm doing, because they are. I really want to acknowledge that women are working so hard in the gym and they're doing so much, but I think that they're spinning their wheels, you know, trying to do too much of everything and not enough of the things that they need to be doing, and shifting that around in a way that's more beneficial.
So do you prefer, I guess in an ideal world, splitting up a program so you have like very specific stimulus for a certain system in the body,
yeah,
versus, you know, the kind of 45-minute functional workouts that encompass everything?
Yeah, I think that I'm very, very big on not shaming those types of classes because I think that they are a great accessible option for a lot of people. But what I usually encourage them to do if they like that, because community and enjoyment are two huge things that keep people invested in exercise. And so what's always optimal might not also be what people are willing to do. But if they're going to do that, then I think they should be complementing it with some specific resistance training on top of that. But otherwise, my personal approach to training is like, let's have a few very specific intentional resistance training sessions every week. And then what you do for the rest of the week, cardiovascularly, if you don't have specific goals, you can kind of do what you want. Most people aren't doing enough volume that it's too worrisome for them to do too much of certain things. But if you have some sort of specific goal, then okay, maybe we are being more specific of those things. And then, you know, in an optimal ideal world, I would love to see people doing actual HIIT workouts, like true high intensity or sprint interval training, not this like group fitness functional version of it, and doing some of that quality high intensity work. So yes, ideally, like my approach is let's keep our strength very specific to strength. Let's keep our easy cardio days intentionally easy cardio. And then let's keep our high intensity stuff specifically high intensity. But I think there's room as well for like, I kind of like bits and pieces of the CrossFit model. And I think some of their like metabolic conditioning type stuff can be effective and fun for a cardiovascular stimulus. But even that, if it's well programmed, is going to distribute resistance and cardiovascular training in a way across seasons or weeks, and that you're kind of getting a little bit of everything. You just want to make sure that you're hitting on all those main things. But yeah, in an ideal world, I would love to see women doing 2 to 3 days of specific intentional weight training, 1 or 2 high quality, high intensity cardio sessions a week, and the rest being either easy cardio or general activity that they like outside of that.
Is that what you call a hybrid training program?
So I think there's a difference between hybrid training and concurrent training. But in the, right now, hybrid's really trendy, right? So I view hybrid training as you're trying to maximize two characteristics that are seemingly opposite in the same training program at the same time. That's how I view hybrid. But I don't care if people say they're hybrid. I have clients that are just doing regular cardio with their strength training, and they're like, I'm hybrid training with Liz. And I'm like, absolutely, own that. I do not care. But that's how I view hybrid, is like, how do we maximize these two things that seem very opposite? Where concurrent training is, how do we balance these two different components of fitness in either the same day, week, or training cycle so that they are either improving together or not conflicting with each other? But it's funny, the talk I'm giving next week is called Hybrid is for Everyone, because I think that the hybrid approach to training, whether you're trying to maximize everything, is the perfect kind of blend of health focused fitness, because it's giving you both of those components of improving your cardiovascular fitness and your strength and hypertrophy in a way that I think the literature makes it very clear both is what you want for health moving forward. So yes, that's what I would call hybrid training. I just think there's that distinction of like, I don't want people to be intimidated that they have to be training for this extreme running or endurance goal while also being powerlifter strong. I always tell people, like, it can look however you want it to look like for you and your life. Because I have clients who are moms, and their hybrid is having the cardiovascular fitness to keep up with their kids and the strength for that longevity that they want as they age. And that is just as valuable as much as like my big hybrid training goals. So, you know, I yes, but also I don't want people to think that you have to be the next ultra marathon or power lifter in order to say you're hybrid training.
But it's possible with the right sort of program and split, mm-hmm, to improve your cardiorespiratory fitness and your strength,
yeah,
at the same time. It's not that one of those has to come at the cost of the other.
For most people, absolutely. I think if we're talking elite level Olympic ends of the spectrum, potentially there's going to be this divide. But for most people, as they go through the beginner and intermediate and even like higher intermediate stages, you can improve both at the same time with good programming and training. I think the biggest limiters for people are more so their time and their schedule of what they can do. But yeah, you can absolutely improve both simultaneously for a very, very long time, or the volume of which you would need for it to start to become that interference to occur is far greater than most people, especially just regular everyday women, are doing in their training. And so, I mean, that's exactly what I do with my clients. We have hundreds of women who aren't getting stronger and running and doing these races or doing cardio at the same time. And that's exactly what we do with the system that I've built. But it's not just me doing this. Like, we're seeing this across the industry as more and more people are kind of waking up from the cardio kills your gains narrative and moving into this, oh, we want to feel athletic and healthy and keep up. And oh, we should probably care about our VO2 max and keep sprinting and jumping as we age too, not just only barbell weightlifting. Like, there's this beauty to having this multidimensional fitness that I think is favorable for health and longevity than just isolating yourself into one.
When could cardio affect your gains?
Yeah. So I don't think we have a specific like cutoff of like, this is how much cardio you need to do. When we look at the data, I think it's really important to make the distinction that cardio doesn't 100% blunt your hypertrophy. There is some, it does suggest that it might for trained individuals, it essentially slows the rate of it, or it's slightly less than what it would be if you were 100% weight training.
Is that HIIT and also steady state sort of low?
There's a mix
cardio
of that in the literature of what's impairing it the most. A lot of that has to do with the high intensity stuff. The high intensity stuff's hard because the studies are so variable in what they use and the protocols they use. It's hard to necessarily say. But yeah, I think that it's a blend of both. Like, there's some data to suggest like running is more fatiguing than cycling because there's a greater CNS or central nervous system fatigue from the running than the cycling. And then like there is a meta-analysis on the HIIT training that kind of shows that it might impact it. But then you look at the effect sizes and the protocols that they use and the order they did them in, and you're like, probably actually doesn't really wash
out
to that.
Does this matter for the everyday person?
Yeah, and it's the same thing with the cycling stuff and the interference stuff. I'm like, yeah, we might be seeing these small differences in the literature, but like the effect size of which it's happening is something that I think over time comes out in the wash. Or one thing that I think gets left out a lot of this stuff. My big thing is, one, if you're going to do this hybrid concurrent training, the molecular interference of what's happening at the muscular level isn't my worry, right? Because it's not 100% blunting it. It's not turning it off entirely and you're never, ever going to grow muscle ever again.
As in, just to break that down.
Yeah.
So the cardio stimulus is affecting muscle protein synthesis. Is that what's happening?
Yeah. So essentially I kind of jumped right into this. When you do resistance training, the mechanical tension that comes from that resistance training signals this pathway that stimulates something called mTOR, which then turns on essentially muscle protein synthesis, creating new muscle tissue and developing that. But then endurance or cardio training, essentially the way that those signals are turned on in the body is that it creates an acute energy deficit in the muscle cells. This is one of the reasons that it's actually good for our health, because it's creating this kind of energy deficit. And so that drives this cell signaling to turn on something called AMPK, which turns on PGC1 alpha, which leads to increased mitochondrial biogenesis and all those adaptations that we want from cardio training. But what happens in that process of that pathway is it blunts that mTOR signaling. So it essentially turns off or blunts or decreases the signaling to the protein that's turning on muscle protein synthesis. And so that is true, and that is very real. But I think that it gets overblown by people to the extent of what that's happening, or you can program and make considerations for training around that. Mixed with, I think nutrition plays a huge status in this as well, and it's leading to this. So we don't have these long-term studies of like, well, if you are doing both of these at the same time for chronic use, like how much is this actually blunting this versus how much are you fed versus the perfect balance out of across the week? Like, we don't have this. This is just best coaching practices based off kind of understanding how the physiological systems work. But the second component of that is a little bit more of my take on it, is there's this central nervous system fatigue that comes from endurance training that in turn reduces the quality of your lifting sessions because you're not able to essentially be as powerful. And then that might blunt and slow those gains and adaptations. And that's where I think balancing that across the week can manage that, either by spacing things out across your day or doing things that are more important on different days, your rest and recovery between those. And then the self-signaling stuff isn't even necessarily becoming as much of an issue if you're planning things in a way where you're getting the signal that you want when you want it, rather than, you know, meshing everything together. But we're seeing these hybrid athletes now who are doing both at very extreme high ends and making progress. I mean, there was that one guy, I can't remember, I think Adam Klink maybe might be his name, I don't remember. He did a 500-pound deadlift and ran a sub-5-minute mile on the same day, right? And you look at CrossFitters and people at these high ends, these spectrums, doing these things who are very muscular and very strong. And I think they're rewriting our version and vision of what that looks like. But I think the important thing is that a lot of these people were strong and muscular before they started it. And I don't think we have data that says, okay, well, if you got strong and muscular first, is that cardio going to wither you away to nothing? And I think the answer is no. But you kind of have to balance when you're focusing on these maintenance specific goals. And so I like to take something called a seasons approach of like, hey, my goal right now is to max my strength and hypertrophy. I'm not going to give up cardio, but yeah, I'm going to pull it down because I only have so much I can recover from in a single given week. But right here, right now, I really need to develop an aerobic fitness base. So I'm going to drive up that version of my training, but I'm still going to keep that minimum effective dose of strength and intensity within that here. So I'm not losing that fitness. And I like to think of hybrid fitness as like, it's a very long-term version of fitness. And I know that's hard for a lot of people to think of, is that you're not going up and down all the time, you're trying to build and stack over time. So your fitness is kind of like going small bits over time, but you're increasing both kind of in oscillation rather than I think a lot of people, well, I'm only going to run for this 6 months. Well, I'm only going to lift for this 6 months. Oh, but I'm going to go back to running. And the goal is to not ever give up one thing entirely, but maybe you're changing the percentage or the priority of that within your life based off your goals or your interest or potentially what you're really lacking and you need to be developing.
With that understanding of how cardio affects AMPK and mTOR, Do you think cardio should be done on a separate day to strength training? If it's done on the same day, should it be before? Should it be afterwards?
Yeah. So my rule of thumb is even when I'm training for my races, I always lift first. I always prioritize strength training first because I think that, you know, cardio training, especially running, right, it's going to be more fatiguing. And so it's giving this greater fatigue to your central nervous system, which is what you want for lifting. And it's more, it depletes your glycogen stores more rapidly than resistance training. So my take is that you should lift first. Now, if you will not lift first, if you can only run first, if that's like the only thing that you can do, like it's, I know I have a lot of clients in the early summers, they're like, but I have to run before I lift because it's so hot. I'm like, you're still like, it's not no benefit. And I think that's where people get confused. They think that it's no benefit. It's just not optimal, but most of us aren't doing the optimal thing. But my view is to lift first if you're going to do them in the same session. And there was a paper that came out in, I think, 2021 that found that if you separate the session by at least 20 minutes in advanced trainees, that it reduced the impact on one rep max strength. And then for beginners and intermediate trainees, it didn't matter if you did them back to back on that effort. And then there's other, you know, data that suggests that you can separate them by 2, 3, 6, 8 hours. So generally I say strength first, cardio after, or strength in the morning, cardio in the afternoon, or switch them if you need to, cardio in the afternoon, strength in the evening, put that space between. And then if you're gonna do them in the same day or the same session, that's where I think we need to be more focused on nutrition too. If it's greater than 60 minutes for you to do both, probably take in some carbohydrate while you're doing that, or at least making sure that you're very well fed before the session. And then if you're doing them split across the day, making sure you have enough protein and carbs to recover between those two sessions. And then otherwise, you know, if you have someone, and I don't think most people need to double up that often. I think most people, they might strength train 3 days a week and do cardio 3 or 4 days a week. You can probably do it all on their own. But if you're going to do them then back to back, I like doing, you know, my hard lifting session with my speed work days potentially. If I don't have a ton of rest days in my week and a lot of wiggle room with putting more intensity later on. But then there's also the take of people do their hard lifting day and then their easy cardio session after, and they save their hard day for its own workout entirely. I don't think either of those are necessarily incorrect or wrong, but then you might want to put that hard cardio session in that hard leg session, so to speak, because usually they're both lower body dominant. Maybe having 48 hours, like an easy day between them or a rest day between them so that you can get the most out of those training sessions. And that's where that balancing that intensity across the week is helpful. Instead of having every day be your high intense day, well, what days are my highest intensity days? What sessions do I care about the most? So during, you know, when I'm race training, I will move my speed work day from slowly being after my strength training session to being on its own day, because I know that I start to care more about that quality of that session and I will put something easier there. But when I don't really care about things as much, I might slap them together a little bit more. And I think it really depends as well, how many sessions are people doing in a week? Are they only lifting 2 days, 3 days, 4 days? Are they doing cardio a couple days a week? Are they actually having high volume cardio goals? And if we center it back to those Gen Pop people that we're really focusing here, most of it doesn't matter. There was a paper that just came out looking at middle-aged people on like doing concurrent training back-to-back, and they both improved health and it didn't appear to interfere with each other, at least in this middle-aged population. So I think for the Gen Pop people, the risk versus reward becomes less and less compared to just like the value of them getting it
just trying to get it
done.
Yeah. You mentioned carbs there. So if someone's, I think what you said was if someone's training for more than an hour and they're doing both cardio and some resistance training, they might want to have some carbohydrates during. What does that look like? How much or what kind of foods are people going to?
If you're doing the resistance training first and then going into the cardio and it's like 90 minutes to 2 hours of total training, I like that 30 to 60 grams of carbs taken in at some point during in that. I don't think you need to go the full 60 to 90 grams of carbs like you might with like a 2 hour run session. Usually like when I do my back-to-back days, I towards the, you know, I eat my breakfast. I usually do like my squat day. And then during the tail end of my squat day, I'll eat like 2 packs of fruit snacks or a couple applesauce squeeze packets or like some crackers or just something like that to get that in. And then I go and do my speed session. If it's really hot and sweaty, I'll also include like an electrolyte during that day. Some people can just do like a carbohydrate drink mix while you're training to have that available. Because some of that fatigue that you might have from that lifting carrying into that cardio session, you know, having your glycogen stores depleted increases that fatigue and muscle damage and demand of the contractility of the muscle. And so I think a lot of people, they struggle with like hybrid or concurrent training, whatever you want to call it, because they're underfed from like, you know, protein's important, but also carbohydrate. And so it's harder to recover from their sessions, but having that, you know, adequate carbohydrate feeding when you're doing that type of stuff can help make it less stressful and less damaging and less fatiguing on the body, but also allow you to have quality in both when you're doing them back to back.
Yeah. And I have to imagine that at least people who are looking to cardio for fat burning, like you mentioned earlier, that there would be a person who is leaning into cardio training but also restricting carbohydrates because they're of the view that carbohydrates increase fat storage.
Yes. And so I sympathize with this because I take such a performance-driven focus to my view of things. And so this is where it also depends on how much are you doing, right? So your carb needs are based off of your activity levels. So if someone is not doing a ton of cardiovascular training in a week, they're not doing 300, 500 minutes of or more of cardio training in a week, your carb needs aren't going to be as high as those people. And so I think when people say, you know, eat enough carbs to support the activity you're doing, they hear me say, eat carbs until you gain weight and get fat. And it's rather that you're using it to support your activity. And so I think a lot of people use cardio for fat burning, but there's a few things to consider here. One, if you're fed going into that cardio session, you're probably going to actually have a higher quality session and burn more calories. Two, cardiovascular training done with the intent of improving your cardiovascular fitness improves your body's ability to burn and use fat as a fuel more efficiently. So like, I think the thing people should be focused on with their training programs is improving their fitness metrics more than did I burn enough calories in the session? Am I doing it fasted so I'm burning enough fat? Don't worry about if you're burning enough fat, because the fat that you're burning for exercise itself, yes, you're oxidizing more fat, but one, that's not directly related to fat loss necessarily. And two, trust me when I say that I spent so much of my PhD analyzing fat oxidation data. The amount of carbs you're burning in those sessions is still so, so much greater than the fat you're oxidizing. We're talking like grams, like not to the extent of which people are thinking that they're burning. You're still using a ton of carbohydrate. And that carb that you're taking in isn't necessarily being stored and converted into fat, because one, when you're doing exercise training, you uptake glucose independent of insulin. So your insulin, even if insulin itself was, you know, what was, you know, causing the obesity and weight gain, like people like to think, you have these transporters in your muscle cells, GLUT4, and they come to the cell wall and they take up that glucose and shuttle it in without insulin. So you have that muscle contraction itself is bringing that in, but then you're essentially using it and bringing it in and putting it directly into your metabolic pathways to burn and use. You're not even at that point in time storing it. You're using it as a way to sustain adequate blood glucose levels for activity so you don't bonk or get that hypoglycemic type feeling that people tend to get when they're underfed during exercise. But it's essentially being directly shuttled in. That's why you want these simple carbs, not these super complex carbs. And it's being shuttled in directly through the bloodstream almost to the muscles or your body's tissues to use for energy metabolism during exercise. So it's not like you're not primed to be in storage mode when you're exercising. You're primed to be, you're upregulating your metabolism to burn and use this fuel that you're doing. And so if you're somebody who's gen pop and you're doing like a 45 minute lift and then like a short hit session and it's like an hour and 15 minutes, you will be fine if you don't eat something. But I'm talking about the people who are doing like an hour lift and then they're doing 30, 45, 60 minutes of cardiovascular training. I would have a little bit of carbohydrate in between there. So again, it kind of depends on the person, but don't think of your session as a time that you're storing fat or even worrying too much about burning fat. Worry about getting fitter and having a higher quality training session, because that's the stuff that moves the needle forward.
So what I'm hearing from you here, and I'll throw this back to you, mm-hmm. is that potentially if you are under consuming carbohydrates for a certain individual, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking back to that avatar of the individual, the woman who is putting the hours in, she's training, but not necessarily getting the progress. And mm-hmm. earlier you mentioned the importance of intensity.
Yeah.
So if someone is restricting carbohydrates, doing a lot of exercise, could that be affecting their intensity?
Yeah. I think one of the biggest mistakes that women make when it comes to training is restricting their food and or carbohydrate intake too much, too frequently, too often, or all of the time. They're taking a dieting mentality to their exercise training. And I think that's a big thing that holds them back from getting results in their training, especially the ones who are like, hey, I'm working out 6 days a week. I'm doing all this cardio. I'm not seeing any results, but they're restricting their carbohydrates and they're burning the candle at both ends. And so I think that, you know, when we think about, even if we circle back to the cycle training stuff, I think the first thing that's the most important for females is to be fed, be adequately fed. And I think that we don't think about things like low energy availability, either in the short term or the long term, in gen pop clients. But a lot of females are doing things that are eliciting low energy availability within their training sessions. And they're not putting their bodies in a state where they're like, yeah, let's just like, we want to recover. We want to give up fat. We want to perform at our best. We want to push into our training sessions. And so they're just kind of on this hamster wheel of chronic moderate intensity exercise where they're never really progressing the intensity or the volume. They're just kind of doing the same thing. And your body does adapt to that. So it's just adapting.
Right. So just
that.
Like turning up, going through the motions sort of with resistance training, going through the motions with cardio. So you are putting in the time.
Mm-hmm.
But to get to the right intensity is sort of stifling progress.
Kind of, yeah. And they're not either able to get to the right intensity or they're not even able to actually progress anything that they're doing. So your body becomes almost adapted to that, right? Like you hear everyone say like, maybe not everyone, you hear people say all the time in the fitness industry, don't run because your body adapts to it and then you gain weight. Well, you become more efficient as you do cardio. That's a positive adaptation to cardiovascular training. But people forget that you can progress cardio training just like you can progress resistance training. They think of cardio as just doing the same thing day in and day out. But if you're not fed or you're not able to do that intensity or you're not able to increase that volume, then yeah, you might just be doing the same workout over and over and over again. And that doesn't mean that you're not getting benefit from a health standpoint. Muscle contraction and oxygen delivery and all that stuff, and the stress in your vascular system, like those things are still happening. You're not getting no health benefit from it. But when you're thinking about trying to push your physique forward or make progress there, you might be holding yourself back because you're not giving yourself, you know, you're not putting gasoline in the engine. And you're just expecting your car to keep moving on fumes rather than being able to accelerate or move forward or go faster or whatever that looks like.
So if someone is in that position, mm-hmm. they feel stuck. Mm-hmm. I guess firstly, what are, other than not getting progress or maybe not seeing progress, what are signs that someone is in low energy availability?
Yeah.
In that state.
So I think that when I talk about this, because so many people struggle with fat loss or weight loss or being overweight or whatever that looks like, they're like, well, there's no way I'm in low energy availability. But there can be short-term acute low energy availability during the day. And then there can be also chronic long-term low energy availability. And so a lot of the signs of like chronic low-term energy availability are going to be things like obsession with food, obsession with body size, like those psychosocial things that are really parallel to disordered eating habits and traits. And then you also have things like you have, you know, alterations to the menstrual cycle, decreases in your menstrual cycle frequency and ovulatory cycles. You're not ovulating or you're not getting your period at all. That's more of the extreme version of it. You have increased inflammation. You potentially have lower bone density, bone loss, things like that. That's one of the biggest concerns of this low energy availability state. But then you also might not be recovering. And if you're not, you know, if you're not making progress in your training sessions, you're not putting on muscle, you're not, you know, recovering, you feel like crap. And it, really what I think for most Gen Pop people is that more of that acute, because I think what they do is they wake up, they have coffee and a breath of air, they eat a salad with barely anything on it for lunch, and then they're like, oh, I'm overeating at dinner, or I'm overeating on the weekend. So they might not be in a long-term state of low energy availability, but they are under eating during the days. And so they're just, you know, stressing their bodies out, and they're not giving it the fuel it needs to recover during that AM training session that they're doing, or when they go to the gym after work, they're going in on fumes, even if they are, you know, eating enough later. And so there can even be energy, low energy availability in the short term from either low intake like that across the day. But another classification of low energy availability, or low energy availability, actually a better way of saying this, parallels is low carbohydrate availability. So a lot of the signs and symptoms that come from low carbohydrate availability, especially in females, parallel or mimic a lot of the signs and symptoms, or work hand in hand with low energy availability. So not having enough carbohydrate to match your training volume or your intensity or what you're doing. And this is, again, more prone in athletes, but I think a lot of females train at the volume they're very active, they're highly active, and they don't eat or treat themselves like they are. And so they're not fueling themselves appropriately for that. And so if you feel like trash, you're not recovering, you potentially, your sleep's, you know, poor, you're always hungry in the middle of the night, your cycles are being impacted, or you feel like, you know, if you get blood work, you can also look at some of the things that are going on in there, but that's potentially, there's a lot of things in people's lifestyles that can also be impacting that, but you don't feel like you're getting your bang for your buck out of your training sessions, consider for a little bit increasing your carbohydrate intake and seeing how that feels. And so even when we circle back to the menstrual cycle, we see that if your performance is impacted during your luteal phase, or if your metabolism is different during the luteal phase, we have studies that show that those differences go away when women are fed carbs. So like some of those discrepancies in the training and performance go away when you're fed carbs, or you're potentially, you know, going to perform equally as well when you're in that fed state, or those differences go away. And so I think that's something that a lot of people neglect because they're trained, restrict, restrict, restrict. And it's not overeat, it's eat to the demands of what you need for your activity level and your body. And so it's hard to say exactly because every person's different, right? You have potentially two very different Gen Pop people. I think of the person who's struggling with fat loss, struggles with exercise consistency, struggles with yo-yo dieting or on and off eating. And then I think of the lean enthusiast who's cardio bunny, chasing all the fat loss, always really highly active, under restricting their activity and calories. But both of them might need to essentially adjust their eating to eat adequately for where they're at. And what that looks like might be different. But if you're not getting the results or progress that you're looking for those things, I usually, especially this phenotype, I'm usually like, let's pull back a little bit on that exercise obsession and let's push food up a little bit more. And it's really scary for them to do that. But I'm like, if you do it and you trust me, you're probably going to see your performance increase, your body composition increase, and you're kind of feel a lot better when you're doing it.
Yeah, that's interesting what you mentioned there about carbohydrate restriction kind of mimicking low energy availability. Mm-hmm. Because as I was hearing you go through what someone may experience, mm-hmm. I imagine there's people listening thinking, okay, I am experiencing that poor sleep, I'm hungry, this and that, but I can't be in low energy availability because I'm not losing weight.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think what's funny too, on top of this, is there's this big obsession right now on cortisol, right? Everyone's obsessed with cortisol.
Spikes cortisol.
And spiking cortisol. And cortisol is making you gain fat. And cortisol is doing all these things. But like, my favorite fact is like, do you know what brings down cortisol or reduces the cortisol response to exercise? Carbohydrates. Like, I think that this chronic push of underfeeding for the performance we're at is still so prevalent in everything we talk about when we're talking to women, that it's taking this diet mindset to fitness and performance. And I really like separating those two. Yes, you can have body composition goals and changing those. I'm not against that at all. But don't take that approach to your training, but also don't take a diet that's going to impact everything you're doing in the gym and just runs the hamster wheel of restriction and restriction and restriction, where you then are on off. Because I think what happens is they're like, well, I'm not losing weight. There's no way. And they're either, you know, in some cases they are chronically under eating, or I think in most cases they're very unaware of how much they're actually eating the times when they are eating versus the rest of the time when they feel like they're borderline starving themselves in order to, you know, be fit or healthy or what they view as the right way to eat. And then on the nights or the weekends or the vacations or the times off, that's when that creeps in and they're not seeing that total average caloric intake, but they're oscillating between the state of low energy availability and then being overfed, low energy availability, or even being adequately fed. But you're still in that state throughout the week when you're, you know, the memes and the jokes of like, oh, I've only had an iced coffee today. I don't know why I feel like crap. Like, that's not funny. That's not a meal. You need to actually feed yourself because you'll perform better. Your cognition will be better and your performance will be better. And you're probably going to see way better results in your training and fitness. And I think one of the most rewarding things for me is when I can get women to trust that. They lift heavy. They're not afraid to do cardio. They're not afraid to just to not diet for a little bit and just eat and fuel themselves for the training that they're doing. And then it almost ends up, you pull that cognitive stress of always obsessing about your body, and then their body composition ends up shifting without as much effort. Because the cognitive effort of doing that high volume of training all of the time and then being micromanaging of your food on people, I feel like makes them feel like they're doing so much more work and effort in the gym that they can't possibly believe that there's an option for them to pull back a little bit on what they're doing or shift and redistribute what they're doing in the gym and eat more food and get more results or better results with half that demand. Like, they feel like it has to be that hard for it to work.
When you say well-fed or adequately fed, mm-hmm. we've spoken a bit about carbohydrates, mm-hmm. but you mentioned protein mm-hmm. earlier. I mean, what are the foundations look like for you? Is it that like many people I hear in this space kind of say, set your protein, get enough carbs, and then fill the rest with fat? How do you approach this?
So I think, yes, I'm very pro moderate to high protein intake for women across the entire lifespan. I think that is something that many people neglect or struggle with. I think a lot of women struggle to get enough protein intake in, either because, one, your caloric needs are lower, so it's harder to have like almost a higher relative percent, it feels like, to you to get that in, or that appetite might not be there, or just not something that you historically have done. So I do think that having that, like, and I think there is some data that suggests that, like, you know, females don't necessarily need all the way up to that 1 to 1.2 that sometimes is recommended. So I'm okay with like that 0.8 to 0.9 up to 1.0 grams per pound of body weight. You guys can do the kilo math
in
my head. Yeah, per pound. You'll have to divide that by 2.2, so to speak. Or 1 gram per pound of lean body mass, or about 2 grams per pound of kilo of lean body mass, I think is also a helpful tool for people if you have body composition data and you know that, as like a minimum. Like, let's eat to at least support our lean mass. I think that's more helpful with people who have a good bit of lean mass.
2 grams per kilogram of lean body mass.
Yeah, give or take. Yeah.
Which is probably around 1.6 or a little bit higher grams per kilogram of total body weight.
Yeah, I would say that 1.6 to 1.8 is probably grams per kilo, now that I'm seeing a slide from back in my head that I made once on this, for kilo is probably about that range. I don't think that we have to go to that perfect 1.0, or I think it's like 2 grams per kilo of body weight for that. I think that, you know, I've seen some data where it kind of flattens out on the curve after about like 0.8-ish for women. But I think there's benefits across the entire lifespan for that. But especially if you are struggling with your hunger and satiety and you feel like you can't lose fat and you feel like you're not making progress in the gym and you're not recovering, like, that's usually a sign that, hey, maybe increasing my protein might help that, because it increases satiation. If you are someone who struggles with that hunger and satiety, it's going to improve your exercise recovery. You're going to be giving the amino acids that your body needs. And then especially like when we think about, you know, the luteal phase or menopause, like, those are time periods where that's probably even more important to be more dialed in with that. I'm of the stance that, like, you don't need to periodize your protein to your period because you just should eat enough all of the time. But you might need those higher demands, but I think I have these three key things that I think are the most important for women and females, and it's enough protein, enough carbs, and enough calories. That doesn't mean to say fat isn't important. So to go back to your industry of like standard of like set the protein and let your carbs and fats kind of fall where they are. I think that's great for regular everyday people. But if you're shifting that volume or intensity up on your training, you're probably going to have to shift that carb preference right,
have
a little
bit
up.
To carbs, which means dialing the fat down a little bit.
And dialing fat down a little bit. And so that's something I see a lot too, especially like when people struggle also too, because they're like, I gained weight when I trained for a race, or I gained weight when I trained for a marathon, or whatever that looks like. And I'm like, because you're hungry and you're not eating enough carbs. And so your body's increasing that hunger because it's wanting to recover and replenish and restore those. But everything around us is hyperpalatable and everything around us is high fat. And I struggle with this, right? Like I'm aware of this and I have a really high carbohydrate demand. And I joke, I say, fats find me. Like no matter, like I have to be super, and I'm not restricting fats by any means, but I still have to be super diligent that I'm not like blowing up my calories with fats when I know my body needs the carbs to support and recover me. And so that's where I'm like, okay, as you start to shift past maybe those exercise guidelines, if you're like 2.5 hours a week in the exercise guidelines and you're a regular person doing stuff, just like eat enough carbs to support yourself. But once you start getting into that, okay, I'm exercising 3, 4, 5, or if you're doing even more than that, like you're training for that first marathon and you've never trained for a marathon before, like you're going to have to shift that preference of that intake, and it will make you feel fuller, you'll recover better, you'll perform better, you're going to feel better. Like it's really scary for people because of the narrative around carbs, but I think it's really important for me to really reiterate that your body isn't just storing these and causing these massive insulin spikes. It's using them to replenish your glycogen stores. They're going into storage. They're not even necessarily like, I mean, your body goes in and out of fat storage and burning throughout the day, but you're refilling your glycogen stores, or your body's using it for energy, for recovery and repair. It's not like, I think that's a hard thing for people because they only think of food going in to be stored and turned to fat, rather than, well, your body's using that to sustain and fuel the recovery or performance or training that you are doing. And again, not everyone has those high performance goals, but I see all the time, I see my Gen Pop clients start training for the first half marathon or their marathon, and that's the first really big spike in cardiovascular activity they've done. Or they've always ran and they decide, they're like, hey, I need to add in strength training. And they're like, why am I always under recovered, or this is really hard, or I'm not adapting? And it's because they didn't adjust their food intake to that increased demands on their body. And that's where I kind of have that view of like, don't bring a diet view to your training. Always make sure that you're feeding and fueling yourself for the activity that you're doing. And that's not to say you can't have fat loss goals, but you probably shouldn't be training for a marathon and having a fat loss goal at the same time. Like that might be something that you need to separate so that you can focus on the thing that you need to be doing at the same time.
Let's imagine someone's listening,
yeah,
and thinking, Alyssa's made a great case here to eat more carbohydrates. But when you say eat enough carbohydrates, mm-hmm, perhaps they're not even sure what that means.
Yes.
Are we talking about having oats at breakfast? Mm-hmm. You know, let's imagine this is a 50 kilogram woman, and we don't have to get super, yeah, specific here, mm-hmm, but are we talking about she's having oats at breakfast, she's having rice or quinoa or potato at lunch and at dinner?
Yeah.
What is enough carbs?
And that's where it's hard, because there's these amazing grams per kilogram recommendation based off total hours of activity that you are doing in a week of training. And I'll try to remember them off the top of my head. But for a 50 kilo woman, what's that, like 130 pounds? I'm like
125, 30? Yeah, 120.
I don't know, something in that range, yeah. It's going to be, yes, including carbs at every meal of the day. And you can keep the starchier, more fibrous, more whole carbs at your meals. Maybe around training is when you might simplify them a little bit. Yeah, 110. So that's even leaner. And so again, it's going to depend on how much they're doing. And so if you're a very low, sedentary, lower end of that spectrum person, it might be something like 2 to 3 grams per kilo of body weight per day. So maybe 100 to 150. Whereas as you go up, and I might be butchering this because I'm thinking of the scale in my head, where you go up and you start becoming more lightly to moderately active, it's going to be something like, 3 to 4 grams per kilo. And then you start to become more moderately active, and it's like 4 to 5 grams per kilo. So she's 110 pounds. It's going to be,
I think it was about 150 to 200 grams.
Yes. And so then
for the moderate,
yes,
level of activity.
And then you're titrating up, and then you get to, this is where it's more like high end athletes. We're getting into, okay, you're training for maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours a week, and then you start eating 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 grams per kilo of body weight. And so maybe a better example is because I know the math on the top of my head. When I was peaking and training for my 50-mile ultramarathon last fall.
Have you done like 10 of those or something?
I've done 10 ultramarathons, yes. I eat.
Just a lazy 10.
I know. I'm training for my first 100-miler, actually. On my high running days, I eat 550 to 600 grams of carbs in a day on those days of training. But when I was in my recovery, and I'm like 64 kilos, that's a better preference for me because I know what I weigh. When I was in my recovery phase, I went down to maybe only 2 hours a week of cardio and some, I was ramping back into lifting. I probably went down to like 200 to 230 grams of carbohydrates a day. So I over halved it, right? Because I went from exercising 10 to 13 hours a week to like 4 to 5 hours a week in total with lifting and running. And so maybe that's a better example of like, I adjusted my carbohydrate needs. I wasn't restricting. I wasn't starving myself. I wasn't on some like extreme diet post 50 miler. I just wasn't as active. So I didn't need as many carbohydrates. So I went back down closer to that 200 range and I did increase my fats. Cause I will tell you, after running those things, you just like are so sick of sugar that all I wanted to eat was like nuts and cheese and fruit for like a month. I can only explain, or like vegetables, not fruit, for like a month. So I did allow myself to increase a little bit of that because I didn't
need
fat
and sodium combo.
Oh, that's all I wanted when I finished that, when I finished those things. But I did, like, I was like, hey, you know, like this volume and training isn't as high. I was kind of only doing the exercise guidelines worth of cardio during my like off season, so to speak. I was only lifting maybe 2 days a week. I kind of took a big break on training. So I pulled that down. So my calories also went from like 2,800 to 3,200 a day down to like 2,200, maybe 2,300 calories a day. And I brought a lot of that down from carbohydrate and then let myself bump up a little bit in fats because of that consideration. Because, okay, the intensity and volume isn't there. I can shift a little bit more fats and still have enough to affect my recovery. But I was well fed in both of those situations and those examples. I was eating enough for my body and the fuel and the activity that I was doing, but I wasn't. When I cut it down, it wasn't like I was like restricting or starving myself. My just energy needs fluxed and they went down and I was well fed there just as much as I was well fed on that other end of the spectrum.
And you're holding protein at a pretty sort of consistent level in both of those scenarios. And that comes back to that kind of, I think you said 1.6 to 1.8 grams per kilogram, roughly there, which again, ballpark, but for an average woman, it's going to land somewhere between like 80 and 120 grams of protein a day.
For most people, I think 100 is a good minimum for most women. And then I think, you know, depending on where they're at, like that 100 to 130 is a good rough range. Cause you know, I get a lot of people too, who do have a lot of adiposity and they're like, there's no way I can eat this much. I'm like, you don't need to be eating 1 gram per pound of body weight. Either think about estimate of lean mass or that lower end of that spectrum of what that might look like. And there are, like, I have friends who are taller and heavier and are very muscular and they are eating more protein than me because they definitely have that. You have to, you know, factor that in a little bit there. But I think that 100 grams minimum, which is like 30 grams per meal plus a snack every single day, is a good minimum for most females. And like, I have like 115 pounds of lean mass. So for me, I try to keep that as my minimum. I try to keep 115 as my minimum. And then I usually flux between like 115 and 140, depending on the day. I don't worry about hitting it perfectly. I think people think that they have to hit these ranges perfectly every single day. Like I've been, and it was scary at first, but I've been doing this for so long that I do these high volumes of cardio or days where my protein isn't as high. And like, I haven't shriveled up into a raisin over the years. So I think there's a bit of that trust factor with that. So I like the 100 grams as a minimum, but then maybe for my more muscular end of the spectrum females, maybe that you know, gram per pound of lean body mass is kind of that minimum.
Are you okay with protein shakes if someone finds it difficult from an appetite point of view to get to 100 grams from Whole Foods?
Yes. I think that a lot of people have this perception that's cheating or it's not food or it's bad to do. But I think especially like of the range of supplements that I recommend for women, I mean, protein shakes are one of the things that I recommend for them because it's easy, it's portable. You might not have the appetite for eating protein across your day. I don't think we should be replacing, you know, the majority of our protein. But if you're drinking a 20 to 35 gram protein shake once a day, depending on like how much you're taking in, I think that's perfectly fine to be doing to be meeting those goals. I mean, protein is still, I mean, they're food-derived supplements. They're not just like these synthetic made-up things. I think people forget that they are technically a food in a way. Yeah, I am absolutely fine with people using some sort of, and you know, I know you're plant-based. It's important to note that like it's totally fine to use a whey-based supplement or a soy pea plant-derived based supplement, and they both are, as long as they're dosed appropriately and have enough protein in them, they're both are fine. You can use either. I actually personally use a plant-based supplement over a whey just due to GI tolerance. And like, that's what I've used to supplement for the last few years. And you can interchange. It doesn't have to be only whey or bust kind of mindset. But yeah, I'm totally okay with that. And it doesn't have to be every day, right? Like you can someday, hey, I'm low today. I'm going to get in a protein supplement or use a protein bar as part of a snack that you incorporate in the afternoons or things like that.
That's really good info. I've had a bunch of convos with people like Alan Aragon, mm-hmm. and we've dived deep into all things protein.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
the common theme really seems to be hitting that total protein being most important. Like many of these things, like we spoke earlier, you can go into the weeds and we can talk about protein distribution and before or after training, and they could be, you know, these could be important in certain contexts,
yeah.
But for the general person, just getting total protein is the most important thing.
Yeah, I think total protein. And then my one caveat of that for women is that I think that there is potentially a slight benefit of us really having that in our systems when we're training. I think a lot of people are like, oh, shotgun a protein shake after you're done training. But I like the idea more of having amino acids already available in your system, especially if we're thinking about, you know, training in that luteal phase where progesterone is high, or menopause when, you know, our amino acid sensitivity is potentially affected or lower. I think that's where we might be like, hey, let's make sure that we have protein in our bodies and systems. Does it have to be a protein shake? No, but a meal or something available in our systems before we're doing this training. So your body kind of has those building blocks within that. Those are like my two caveats. But again, at the end of the day, if you mess it up, the protein intake at the whole day matters more than anything. So yes, I totally agree.
Is that something that you would need to have, you know, at least 30 minutes, an hour or so before a workout for it to actually make a difference, or can someone slam a protein shake right before they walk into a workout?
I would say a lot of that comes down to GI tolerance. I like the idea for something like protein, usually 30 to 60 minutes out, just so you can digest it a little bit. I mean, if you're resistance training, you might not have as much of a GI distolerance for things. So you might be able to like take something in. So I think that it's probably ideal. It's either 30 to 60 minutes or longer in that pre-workout meal. Or if you're going to do it, you can do it right before your session, but just make sure that you're just not going to, you know, have an upset. So, I mean, that might work a little bit more before lifting than running. My idea is more so that you have, by the time you complete that session, you have those amino acids through your digestive tract and into your bloodstream, rather than, okay, I just finished the workout, but my body's looking for these to recover and repair. That's why I've always been more pro. Let's make sure we have protein in before, because after you're going to probably eat a meal within the next hour or so. So you're probably going to get that in at some point or another. But I think that a lot of people, you know, they either don't get any food in before they train or they don't get any protein. And then my one other thing to that is like, if you can't get protein in before you're training, because like you're rolling out of bed, you have kids, it's super busy, it's super early, get at least some carbohydrate in, because carbs to some degree are protein sparing. And so having that available will help kind of tease off some of that breakdown or an excess that we might not want.
So your body's less likely to take protein, mm-hmm. break that down and turn it into energy.
Yeah, because there's a backdoor pathway where protein can get turned into carbs, and then those carbs can be used for energy metabolism. So if you're going to, at the minimum, at least do carbohydrates. And then my timing recommendation for that is at least 30 minutes before or less than 10 minutes. Because what happens if you do that wonky in between of like, you kind of get that insulin response and then you start training and then you have like two mechanisms taking your glucose up and then suddenly you're lightheaded in the gym. So you might have that drop. So I like it like right before or the meal that's at least 30 minutes before the
right,
training.
So ideally you have some amino acids on board.
Some amino acids, yes.
Otherwise, if you're running out the door, grabbing a banana is going to be better.
Yeah, I think people really overthink this too, especially the fasted morning training. You know, there's this big take with like, fasted versus not versus training in women versus males. And I'm pro, like, you should be, I really think that most females should be fed before they exercise because of the energy availability and our sensitivity to that. But people think that they need to be like, do I have to get up an hour before and eat a whole meal? Let's drink a glass of chocolate milk, eat like a couple applesauce packets or a banana or something that's light, easy, digestible. It doesn't be heavy. It doesn't need to be like 500 calories. It can be 100 or 200 calories, super easy, out the door. And yeah, it's exactly that. It doesn't need to be this like super, super fancy, formal, well-digested meal. You just want your body to kind of have something going into that training session.
There you have it, friends. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did and want to stay up to date with future episodes, be sure to hit that subscribe button on YouTube and follow on Apple or Spotify. Finally, thank you for showing up and the effort that you're making to take control of your health. I look forward to hanging out with you again in the next episode.